Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. We're kicking off Monday morning with a wander around some of New York and LA's finest art exhibitions. And the person we've made do the walking to fill us in on what's adorning the gallery walls is Charlotte Burns. And Charlotte, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us. As always, let's begin things in Los Angeles at the Gagosian for a show titled Helen Frankenthaler, Line into Colour. Colour into Line. Frankenthaler was a renowned American artist, eminent among the second generation of post-war American abstract painters, and the show contained 17 paintings by the artist who died in 2011. Charlotte, I guess that's the place to start. Tell us about some of the pieces on show.
Well, Helen Frankenthaler is most famous for a work she created in 1952, which was called Mountains and Sea. And that work was this sort of, it was later described as a bridge between Jackson Pollock and what was possible. So this has come to define her, and it's come to define all the sort of representations of her in history books, this sort of 1952 moment, because she created a new technique where she stained raw canvas with pigments that she'd thinned out with turpentine. And that meant that the colour soaked into the fabric of the canvas, which was raw rather than sitting on top of a canvas that had been primed. So Helen Frankenthaler is often stuck in this moment when she was 23. And actually she carried on painting and was incredibly prolific and inventive for almost six decades after 1952. So what this exhibition tries to do is to look in those overlooked periods, those decades, and look at some of the work she made all through this idea of line and colour.
Tell us a bit then about how they've put the show together, because obviously I guess you could just look at a simple chronology, which would make the point that you just made there fairly eloquently. I know there's paintings from right up into what, the sort of mid-1980s. Is it a chronological depiction of her work? And as such, does it represent a good intro to her work, maybe for the uninitiated?
Yeah, it does, because by using this idea of line and colour, you know, it's a gallery show, so it's not a museum show, so there's you can't have 150 works or something. There's just not going to be the room or the space to display that. I think what they were trying to do here was a neater summary. And a nice way of tying things up is to, rather than, otherwise they probably would have had to have gone sort of like, you know, let's look at the rest of the 50s, let's look at the 60s, 70s, 80s, and focus in decades. And I think this was a nice way of giving them a prism into that kind of chronological overview, but using a different form. So rather than having to stage series of exhibitions, they can look at the way in which Frankenthaler's work changed using this kind of hook of line and form. She was an abstract expressionist who helped found this movement called the color field movement. Mm. And you see there's a real sense of a kind of graphic impulse in the 50s that gets toned down through the 60s. And then there are linear elements to some of those works, but it's not really until the 70s that you see really distinct graphic elements coming back in. And then she's experimenting using squeegees and masking out strips of bare canvas. And then she kind of brings together drawn elements with lots of other kinds of ways in which she's been experimenting in works that she made in the 80s. So it's kind of amazing to see it. It's just a useful way, I think, of delving into a few of these different decades and looking at the way in which her work evolved and progressed. And what strikes you is the influence that her work has had on so many other artists as well.
Mm. I wonder, it's always interesting with these kinds of shows then, especially 5 years after these artists pass away. Do you think it prompts people to look again? Obviously, it's good if people maybe are less familiar, or it casts a light into some of the areas that are perhaps less well known. But do you think it prompts a review of where these artists sit, particularly, you know, artists who, as you say, you know, worked for so many years and influenced so many?
I think so. I think that's also the goal of them. I mean, this exhibition was organized by John Elderfield, who was the former chief curator of painting and sculpture at MoMA. And he retired a few years ago, and since then he's been working on various projects, one of which has been this relationship with Gagosian, organizing exhibitions for the gallery. This is the third Frankenthaler show that John has organized for Gagosian, and he was good friends with Helen. She actually wrote to him after he'd staged an exhibition, his first show at MoMA. She wrote to him and said, you know, I loved your work, maybe you'd like to meet me. And then they met, and she said, maybe you'd like to write a book about me. And he said, well, you know, I'm quite busy, I'm not sure I can. And then over time, he said he eventually caved in, because he wrote one of the foremost books that's been published on Frankenthaler. I think it came out in 1989. And he's really incredibly familiar with her work. You know, these works in the 80s he said he was going to her studio. He said, you didn't turn up to Helen's studio with a bottle of wine, you came with a squeegee, because she liked experimenting with materials. And so he's a sort of terrific authority on her work, and his move out of an institutional context into a gallery context has allowed him this freedom to stage shows that can be put on pretty quickly. You know, he said when you write a book about an artist in their lifetime, which is what he did, there's certain things you make a pact, it's a kind of unspoken pact with the artist that you're going to leave out. And Frankenthaler didn't want certain things discussed, like the fact that she was a female artist, or her relationships with Clement Greenberg, or her marriage to Motherwell. She didn't see that they informed her art, whereas, you know, of course, the life informs the art and the other way around. And so I think this is sort of Elderfield's way of continuing that conversation that he began with her so many decades ago. It's a commercial show, so the reasons behind it commercially, you know, the market, when the market's hungry, one of the benefits of that, it overturns stones that have been face down for a long time and brings up whole new periods. And that's what's happening here, that there's a big demand for ABEX artists. And if you can broaden that scope of that demand by saying, well, you know, these works, you know, you're not going to get anything from the 1950s by Frankenthaler, because that's the period she was so famous, so a lot of those works are in museums and private collections. But there's a ton of material in the estate from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and, you know, some of these works are just as terrific as works that she was making in the 50s.
So time to look again, and you can do that at Helen Frankenthaler, Line into Colour, Colour into Line. It's on at the Gagosian until the 29th of October. Charlotte, let's go to the Whitney in New York for an exhibition of work by Cuban artist Carmen Herrera at the, I'll say it, impressive age of 101. Herrera is still active in the art world, creating abstract geometric paintings and drawings. Charlotte, one of the interesting things about Herrera, aside from being a centenarian and still busy, is she's been making art throughout her life, but she's been more of a success more recently. Why do you think that is?
I've realised this is my week of talking to you about overlooked artists who are having their turn in the spotlight, which wasn't intentional, but I guess that's just, it's the season for discovery. Carmen Herrera, she was around in Paris in the years that, you know, artists such as Ellsworth Kelly were, after the war, when there was this great meeting of émigrés who forged new paths in all kinds of culture, including art and painting. And Carmen Herrera was one of these artists who began experimenting. You know, she was very influenced by stuff that she said she'd never seen. She said she saw abstract art and was sort of angry that she didn't even know that she could work in this way. And she went back to her studio and began furiously working. And there's lots of reasons why she was overlooked. She herself has said that success is all about being in the right place at the right time, and she happened to never be in the right place at the right time. So I guess some of it's luck. I guess part of it too is that we tend to, in art history and in the art market, put people in boxes. So, you know, there's postmodern art, and then we break people down geographically. So she's been put in the kind of Latin box for a long time, despite the fact that she's lived in New York for decades. Also, she's a woman, and she remembers a dealer telling her at a party, again, decades ago, that she could paint circles around any of the male artists of her generation, but that she would never give Carmen a show because she was a female artist and she just wouldn't sell as well. And I believe Carmen spoke about this in the Guardian newspaper and said, oh, well, she's dead now, which I thought was really amusing. It's a moment where, you know, she's been in obscurity for decades, and then Listen Gallery, when it opened in New York last year, staged a massive exhibition of her work. A documentary came out, and this Whitney exhibition was in the pipeline. So people have been paying attention to her, and she's 101, and it's kind of amazing that, you know, if you're patient for long enough, then success will find you.
Let's look a bit more at the work then. You've talked eloquently already about it. We're dealing with this abstract geometric style in many cases. I wonder about her training, because she trained to be an architect, is that right? And there is a sort of a technical, an architectural, almost structural quality to some of these pieces. Do you think that you can trace some of those lines through it?
Well, she was interested in being an architect. She studied art history and architecture when she was educated in Paris and Havana. And she said that one of her regrets is that she didn't become an architect, but at the same time, she didn't really have the temperament to be an architect. She didn't really want to deal with clients' demands. So in the end, she probably chose the right career for her, because nobody was really interested in her. She didn't have to please anybody apart from herself. So she just made work that she wanted to make, which if she'd been an architect, she couldn't really have done, because she'd have had to have taken commissions. So it would have been a different life. But yeah, you do definitely see this interest in, you know, in geometry, and these sort of expert angles of her work. Absolutely, there's an architectural influence.
And that's Carmen Herrera, Lines of Sight. It's on at the Whitney Museum through till January the 2nd. Finally, Charlotte, let's head to Worcester Street to Deitch Projects for a postmodern painter, Walter Robinson. This retrospective takes a look at his work from 1979 through 2014. Charlotte, tell us more about Walter Robinson's work, first of all.
Walter Robinson is another rediscovery for a lot of people, and his subject matter couldn't be more different than Carmen Herrera's, where she is abstract. He is decidedly engaged in consumerist utopias and the objects and people of our desire. So whether it's hamburgers and cheeseburgers and veggie burgers, or beer or bourbon or babes, or, you know, people who are advertising their wares in phone booths, Walter paints things that people want to consume. And he's been doing that for decades.
Yeah, I mean, he's described in some quarters as a neo-pop painter, and I guess that kind of speaks to what you're just saying. What would you understand by that label, and do you think it's appropriate?
I don't know if he's neo anything, because he's been painting for a really long time. I think that Walter, he was part of the Pictures generation in the 1980s, that group of artists that came out of Metro Pictures Gallery and included artists like Richard Prince, where they were reappropriating found material. So Walter, and still works this way, where, you know, currently I think he's using images from catalogues with striped shirts, or he looks at, you know, Macy's shopping catalogues, or Land's End, I think is what he uses, and he takes images of these, as he calls it, consumerist utopia, where you have people of different genders and races all in neatly segmented, as if life falls into seasons like summer and spring, and these people being incredibly happy with their winter coats. So he takes these images and he repaints them. So he was associated with that generation, and he had quite a lot of success in the 80s. I mean, he was painting kind of pulpy nurse paintings before Richard Prince. He developed a method of spin painting long before Damien Hirst. And then he sort of stopped painting in the 80s, and I think due to various personal circumstances and a kind of crisis of confidence. And he's basically picking up where he left off. And in the meantime, he had this incredibly successful career as an editor of the art publication ArtNet. So he had this sandwich career, which was very successful, and then he's gone back to his earlier career of painting now that he's retired. And he's basically been recognised. He almost made it in the 80s, and so hopefully he's going to make it now instead. He was doing great work then, and he still is now. There's something very clumsy about his work, and he intends it to be that way, even though he's really very technically gifted, and his work is very sincere, and it's almost as if he's not quite comfortable with how sincere it is, so he makes it a little bit sarcastic and a little bit sly at the same time.
And Charlotte, tell me a bit more about the exhibition, because you've talked about how it references all these pop culture motifs. In a big retrospective like this, with a big sweep of time, do you think that it has, as well as being a history of his work, it's also a bit of a social history as well, isn't it? I mean, I guess, like you mentioned earlier, like Richard Prince, he uses so many of these motifs. It does tell a social story as well.
It does, yeah. If that's what you're, you know, he's concerned with the life in the images around him, I think is probably the better way of putting it. He paints whatever was sort of around him. So there's a period where he's painting images of his young daughter, and they're these absolutely gorgeous images which are completely free from any kind of cynicism. Then he paints images of her toys because he wanted to have something permanent for her to remember her childhood by, and for him to remember, I guess, as well. Then he paints images of, you know, these pretty lewd images of people completely naked, and tumescent, which he said at his age is a word of inspiration. And people around, it's all about longing and it's all about desire, and I guess you can say that that's marked through the objects themselves. You know, there's a period when he was painting TV dinners, and this seems to me, when you look at these works, to just suggest an incredible loneliness and deep longing and a sort of sense of being isolated, and you can tell that through a TV dinner. So I guess, yes, there is a history there.
Indeed. Well, you can catch work by Walter Robinson at Deitch Projects in New York through till October the 22nd. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Charlotte Burns in New York, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
For more art hits, don't forget that we're going to be broadcasting Midori House live from Frieze London this Wednesday and Thursday. And be sure to tune into Culture with Robert Bound next Monday, when he'll be speaking to the artist Christian Markley about his new show at White Cube. This has been the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. And the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. Baylen Leonard will be on hand with some musical picks for the week ahead. But for now, thank you for listening.